From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump in Puerto Rico.
In Texas and in Florida, we get an A+. And I'll tell you what, I think we've done just as good in Puerto Rico, and it's actually a much tougher situation.
Also today, Las Vegas officers knew exactly what they were up against.
Copy. Is there a unit down?
Repeat, just be advised, it is automatic fire. Fully automatic fire from an elevated position. Take cover.
Investigators are saying that the Vegas shooter did indeed have at least one so-called bump stock. We'll look at the legal market for these modifications that turn semi-automatics into something very close to fully automatic weapons. And Boston filmmaker Demaine Davis on directing the Oprah-produced show Queen Sugar.
We are all here, Daddy. We will live out the legacy you left us.
That is my story.
That's a story. There's more.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we'll begin today in Puerto Rico, where millions of Americans are still without food, water, electricity, or gas. Today, President Donald Trump touched down on the island after criticism from local officials, including the mayor of San Juan, over the federal government's response to the Puerto Rican crisis. And upon arriving, President Trump received a briefing on the relief efforts, and he said this.
I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the every death is a horror, but if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. And what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands.
That was President Donald Trump in Puerto Rico earlier today. Well, the Boston Globe's David Abel has been reporting from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and he just left San Juan this afternoon. He joins us now from Miami. David, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us what you saw on the island and what people told you.
Well, I literally just landed in Miami, and I was there for nearly a week, and to hear what President Trump just said is breathtaking and almost mind-boggling in the sense that the widespread nature of the damage is a catastrophe, I would say, beyond explanation. As far as the death toll and the count, we really have no idea at the moment. Mm-hmm. Communications have been down across the island for nearly 2 weeks since the hurricane hit. There is no gas for a lot of people. You have to wait on lines from 4 to 8 hours to get gas. Nearly everyone on the island has no electricity and no running water in their house. Mm. I've spoken to a lot of officials on the island. They still don't know. And I actually this morning, right before leaving, was at the main morgue in San Juan, and they are being flooded with bodies. They have had to create, there are four temporary storage units where additional bodies have been coming in because, in part, funeral homes have been unable to store the bodies there. And then there are not just necessarily people who die in the ways that we think of as an immediate consequence of a natural disaster like a hurricane or an earthquake where a building falls on them or they drown, but there are all kinds of secondary casualties.
Yeah.
And you know, there are many people who are suffering greatly right now. And it's really hard to enumerate.
So David, just I'm gonna in a minute I'm gonna ask you a little bit more about what people on the island think about the federal government's response, but tell us a little bit more. I mean, were you able to travel all around Puerto Rico? Because, I mean, obviously a lot of effort focused on San Juan and other more populated areas. But, you know, in the early days after the hurricane, we were hearing that there were some parts of the island that were, like, actually inaccessible, so we didn't even know how much damage or what had happened to people there.
Exactly. We did. We traveled east and west and south and saw as much of the island as we could get to. And there were parts that we couldn't get to because we would be driving, and then all of a sudden the road wouldn't be there anymore. There are bridges, critical bridges, that were washed away, and we were following maps, and we just had to turn around in various cases. Yeah. But I was on, as you said at the top, I was on St. John and St. Thomas in the immediate aftermath of Irma, and the damage there was intense and horrifying, and there's no way to mitigate what has happened to those islands. But I think what was astonishing to me is the breadth of the damage across Puerto Rico. And what I mean is from the south, a town where the eye of the storm washed ashore at the first point in Puerto Rico. I mispronounce it regularly. It's Yacuboa, mm-hmm. Yocuboa. But it you know, the hills have lost so many trees. It's an incredibly lush place that has no more green. Wow. The trees have been hit so hard that they don't even have bark on them.
So totally denuded then.
Completely.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt you, David. But before we run out of time, I did want to ask you, you know, we remember seeing images of the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulin Cruz, for example. I mean, she's been quite critical of the federal government's response. We've seen images of there were tens of thousands of containers with supplies stranded at some Puerto Rican ports because the infrastructure to get those supplies further inland wasn't up and running. I mean, what did the average Puerto Ricans whom you were able to speak to, what did they think about the federal government's response?
Well, some people have asked me about what they thought about what Donald Trump has been saying. And the first response to that is that most people have no idea what he's been saying because they have no access to TV. Right. They have no access to radio. They're not hearing anything.
Yeah.
But as far as what I have seen from the federal government's response, and there is incredible concern and anger that there is a lack of federal troops on the ground, and there has been. It's ramping up today. It's been ramping up in the last few days, but we're talking about a pretty significant island, and all over the place there was no sign of federal presence. And there is a vast need for security. There's a vast need for help with heavy equipment, and people. There's a lack of cash. People can only now take out $200, mm-hmm. and they have to stand online to get that money for sometimes 8 hours,
wow.
Or longer. There was a guy who couldn't get gas. He had to spend 40 hours online. And then he died.
He died?
Because he had a pre-existing issue.
Oh.
There's so many stories. You can't walk, you can't drive throughout any part of Puerto Rico and not hear a significantly tragic, sad story.
Well, that's David Abel, reporter for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Miami. He's just back on the mainland from a reporting trip to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. David, we're going to have you back soon to hear more of what you saw, and we look forward to reading what you put in the Globe. Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on the challenges in Puerto Rico.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Federal and state investigators are still trying to figure out why Stephen Paddock murdered at least 59 people and injured more than 500 in Las Vegas on Sunday night. But we're starting to get deeper reporting as to how he did it. Two automatic weapons, or guns modified to behave like automatic rifles. In all, Paddock had 42 guns in his Mandalay Bay hotel room and his Mesquite, Nevada home. He also had a stockpile of weapons and explosive chemicals that were basically fit for a commando unit. In fact, on the night of the attack, police communications show exactly how quickly Las Vegas law enforcement officers knew what they were up against. Listen to this. At 10:08 p.m. Sunday night, an officer on the scene calls in the alarm.
1697 means we got shots fired at 4:15 a.m. at the Route 91. Sounded like an automatic firearm.
Sounded like an automatic firearm, the officer says. Just 5 minutes later, another officer is inside the Mandalay Bay, just one floor below Paddock.
I'm inside the Mandalay Bay on the 31st floor. I can hear the automatic fire coming from one floor ahead, one floor above us.
Copy. Is there a unit down?
Repeat. Just be advised, it is automatic fire, fully automatic fire from an elevated position. Take cover.
That is correct. It's fully automatic fire. I'm right below it.
It's police communications from the night of the Las Vegas attack, and the officers were right. There are reports now that at least one of the guns Paddock had been modified with the so-called bump stock, a legal device that makes a semi-automatic firearm behave very much like a fully automatic weapon, capable of firing 450 to something like 900 rounds per minute. Well, reporter Alex Yablon has looked into the manufacture and rise of these so-called bump stock. He's with The Trace, an independent nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States. He joins us now from New York. Alex, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, bump stocks. I think for a lot of folks, this is the first time they've ever heard of a bump stock. What is it?
Well, basically, they're devices that allow a shooter to kind of take advantage of just the natural force produced by the recoil of a gun to pull the trigger much, much more frequently than they would if they had to actually squeeze with their own finger every single time they wanted to fire a shot. So, instead of you squeezing the trigger, you're using the force of the gun to have this trigger squeeze your finger.
The recoil of the gun itself.
Right, exactly.
I see. And, go ahead.
Yeah, and they've just kind of been novelties for the most part, but I will say that in 2013, Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, did actually introduce legislation to outlaw them nationally, but it didn't go anywhere.
Well, we actually have some tape from a 2013 hearing that you're referring to, where Senator Feinstein of California talked about these bump stocks. It was a hearing on an assault weapons ban that she had introduced, and here's that tape.
You can buy what's called a bump fire stock legally. This, as I said, is legal. And it allows a semi-automatic firearm to be fired as quickly as a fully automatic shotgun, machine gun, which has been banned for decades.
So, Senator Feinstein, they're making the point that these are legal. But, I mean, how close to the legality line do the bump stocks come? Because, I mean, a lot of people might say converting a weapon into something that can fire 900 rounds per minute sounds awfully lot like a machine gun.
Well, the important distinction is not in how many rounds they fire per minute, but rather how they do it. The definition of a machine gun, it doesn't say anything about speed. It's just can you hold down the trigger once and keep shooting until you're out of bullets? Whereas a bump fire stock, it doesn't make it so that you can just hold the trigger down and keep shooting, but rather it just allows you to pull the trigger much more quickly.
I see.
So obviously for laymen, that may not mean very much, but, you know, from an engineer's perspective, it's a big difference.
So I didn't mean to interrupt there, but how popular are these and who makes them?
Only a couple companies make them. There's one called Slide Fire. There's another one called Bump Fire. They're not very big companies. You know, I was on the Slide Fire website trying to see which retailers stock them, and they only list under 20 retailers throughout the entire country. To get an idea of what that means compared to the full number of gun stores around the country, there's something like between 50 and 60,000 licensed retailers selling guns in the country.
I see. You know, so as far as Slide Fire, they're the Texas-based company, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So we looked at a letter from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives that the ATF essentially sent to Slide Fire back in 2010. Slide Fire put this. You actually put a link to it in your story, and they have it available on their website. And this is a letter from ATF that says yes, the bump stocks that you're selling are legal. They don't convert weapons into machine guns. And they find that bump stock is a firearm part not regulated as a firearm under the Gun Control Act or National Firearms Act. But earlier in the letter, we also noted that the ATF said to Slidefire, this company, that they had written a letter advising the ATF that the stock is intended to assist persons whose hands have limited mobility to bump fire an AR-15 style rifle. So was its original intent to help people who had trouble firing the rifle to begin with?
I should go take another look at that. The thing is you can bump fire a weapon even without one of these things. You know, if you just sort of hold it, to your side, like a regular AR-15, hold it to your side without one of these stocks, you can fire it, but it's just wildly inaccurate. With one of these stocks, you can have a bit more control and still achieve the same effect. Certainly the marketing of these things would not suggest it's in any way intended to help people who, say, have limited mobility. It's just sort of kind of a way to get full auto thrills with a semi-automatic weapon.
Yeah. So I'm seeing from you did really great reporting on this a couple of years ago, and you said a bump fire stock costs only about $99. In comparison to if you were to legally buy a machine gun, that would cost you $20,000-$25,000. I mean, so how popular are these stocks? I mean, you said that they may not get sold in a lot of places, but do we know how many of them have been sold?
It's kind of impossible to say because, you know, these are, they're only made by a couple small privately held companies that don't have to make any kind of public disclosures. They're not, because they're just like a plastic part and not a, a serialized firearm, the ATF doesn't actually keep track of how many there are. So it's kind of impossible to say. I would be surprised if they're particularly widespread, though, because, they're not really useful for a lot of the kind of more common firearm pastimes like hunting, or even target shooting. A lot of ranges won't let you shoot rapid fire. They won't even let you shoot a regular semi-automatic weapon as quickly as you possibly can.
Have any states moved to regulate these?
A couple states have passed laws that take aim at similar accessories. California has a law outlining what it calls multi-burst trigger activators. That law very, very clearly applies to some similar accessories. There's something called a GAT crank that basically you attach a little crank to the trigger and turn it, like an old-fashioned Gatling gun, and that's what you use to pull the trigger more quickly. That's very clearly prohibited under the California law. It's not clear, though, if this law necessarily applies to these bump stocks. And I've actually been in touch with some attorneys this afternoon to try to answer that, and they're a little bit unclear on this as well.
Hmm.
The Slide Fire's website says they're not aware, they haven't been notified by any state governments that their product is restricted, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, a California, the California Department of Justice would take kindly to this product.
Right.
And Connecticut Minnesota and I believe, let me just double check here, and Iowa also have similar kinds of laws as well.
It does make you wonder if now some states may take a closer look at these modifications, especially if indeed something like that was used by the Las Vegas shooter. But Alex Yablon, reporter for The Trace, an independent nonprofit news organization dedicated to expanding coverage of guns in the United States, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And by the way, we've got a link to Alex's article on bump fire devices. That's at radioboston.org. Well, an MIT professor is among three scientists awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. Rainer Weiss will share the prize with Caltech professors Kip Thorne and Barry Barish for their work detecting gravitational waves. Now, these are the waves that are created when two massive celestial objects like black holes collide or are ripped apart. And that is the amazing sound of gravitational waves sent out from two black holes colliding. Now, these gravitational waves were discovered just a couple of years ago, but they were predicted by Albert Einstein, nonetheless, more than a century ago. Speaking at MIT this morning, Rainer Weiss gave credit to the dozens of researchers who have worked on the project over the years.
I certainly feel humbled to be put in the same category as some of the giants of physics. That's sort of unbelievable in a way. I mean, these people I regard, I've read about forever in my life. And that to be put in a category that's even approaching them is sort of unreal, I have to say. And one of the things I sort of dreamt about a while ago is that if Einstein was still alive, it would be absolutely wonderful to go to him and tell him about the discovery. And he would have been very pleased, I'm sure of that. But then we told him what the discovery was, that it was a black hole. He would have been absolutely flabbergasted because he didn't believe in them either.
Weiss then closed his statements with this last comment.
This prize and others that are given to scientists is an affirmation by our society of gaining information about the world around us from reasoned understanding of evidence, a process that is currently in some jeopardy.
Well, congratulations once again to Rainer Weiss and the entire team at MIT who are behind the equipment that were used in detecting these gravitational waves. We've had the privilege of having some of them on our show. Go to our website, radioboston.org, for links to those conversations. And long live great science. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When award-winning director Ava DuVernay began work on her television series Queen Sugar, which airs on Oprah Winfrey's own network, she made the decision that every single episode would be directed by a female director. DuVernay then set out to assemble a powerful array of talented female filmmakers, and one of them is Boston's own Demaine Davis.
To have Demaine join us, such a steady hand, such a strong grasp of story and narrative, and another big, big cast and crew favorite. Everybody loves Demaine, and just so thrilled that she contributed to our story.
Well, that was Ava DuVernay singing the praises of Demaine Davis, and she was so thrilled that she asked Demaine to direct another episode for season two of Queen Sugar. Its mid-season premiere airs tonight on the OWN Network, and Demaine Davis joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So how does it feel to have no one less than Ava DuVernay sing your praises?
It makes my heart race a little bit, a little cold, sweaty palms. And I still can't believe it. Whenever I see any tape, that tape, I'm like, what? Is this real life? Just pinching myself
all
day.
It is, and you're highly deserving of it. So just accept the love.
Thank you. So
tell us a little bit about Queen Sugar and, you know, how it is that Ava pulled you into being one of the directors.
So Ava actually reached out to me on Twitter in 2015. Gonna bronze that Twitter email. And she she had asked me if I had any, initially if I had any scripts, because she was putting together a writer's room. And I sent her a couple of scripts that I had submitted to the Sundance Episodic Labs. Didn't get in, but I sent her those. And we started to, you know, email back and forth. And then she has her releasing company, Array, where she, you know, buys films and releases them. And she does an Array Day every year where she allows anyone from Twitter to ask filmmakers questions. And she asked me if I wanted to be a part of that. I said, oh, sure. And I did that twice. And the second time after I had done it, she said, thanks so much for doing this for me. I really appreciate it. And I was like, anytime, whatever you need. And she sent me back a little yellow heart. And I remember going, okay, all right, I'm not going to respond to that. We can't just keep writing her. She's a very busy person. And that same day, I got a call from Paul Garns saying, did you talk to Ava? I go, no. Oh, yeah, she wants to offer you episode 206. I was like, what? So, yeah, and that's how it happened.
So then what was it like for you? Working on the episode in the series, not just because of, I mean, we should talk about the series itself, but
sure,
also
yes.
because of what Ava's trying to accomplish. Because I've heard her, I read in a different interview where she said, you know, no one blinks an eye that Game of Thrones is entirely directed by men, for example. So why
right.
can't we have a series that's entirely directed by women?
Right, right. It's funny, you know, until I learned that she was using all female directors, I thought to myself, wow, I've never worked with a female director of photography before.
Yeah.
And I've directed 50 or 60 commercials, two independent feature films, and it just kind of hit me like, what am I doing? And it's all about asking. And that's when you ask, you open a door. So, you know, my producers, sometimes you end up working with people who they're like, oh, you like that person, you want to work with them again? Sure. Oh, this person will do it for this much money cheaper. Yeah, let's stay at their, you know, at their cousin's house so we can use the rest of the money towards something else. Great. But I finally said, no, I'm going to work with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I called a friend of mine, Shaz Bennett, who's also a filmmaker, and she gave me a bunch of websites and eventually gave me the first female DP that I worked with. But I think it's interesting that until she did that, and then I hadn't had a realization. And then the second season, for Queen Sugar, it's all female directors and all female editors.
Oh, interesting.
Which is pretty incredible. So I feel fortunate, just incredibly fortunate to get down there and see, you know, so many people of color, women of color working in that crew, making it happen. It was an amazing, transformative experience.
Wow. And so in the first season,
mm-hmm.
The episode that you directed, tell us about that.
Okay, so that was second season.
Second season.
Yep. A lot happened. So Queen Sugar is based on a book, and it's about three siblings. Two are based in Louisiana, and the sister is in Los Angeles, and they come together after a tragedy in the family, and they inherit their father's sugarcane farm.
Yeah.
And then it's about what are they going to do? How are they going to make this work? First of all, it's such a beautiful show. Like, it is, it's gorgeous. You can really see everyone's skin tone. You can really see. It's a show where you go, oh, my God, look at the colors. Like, look at the colors of our people. Look what they look like. And the way that she's originally devised the show from the first season with the first season DP, Antonio Calvacci, the framing, the way that she's chose to do it, it's almost like, in her words, it's like you're watching a film. So you're watching a film for
yeah.
an hour. So my episode was 206. I was shadowing the director, before the other director who's going to work in 204. I got the script. I started to read it on set, and then I was like, I can't read this here because I'm freaking out because so much is happening, and I was so excited. So I got back to my hotel. I had to read it once as a fan, freaking out, and then again, like, okay, now you have to direct this, like, calm down. So a lot of stuff happens. Charlie, one of the siblings, opens up a sugar mill. So, you know, they built a sugar mill. And so, like, it wasn't built when I first got the script. It was done.
Oh, okay.
Ralph Angel, one of the other siblings, divulges something huge to the family, and everyone reacts. And they're also having the dedication ceremony to their father's tomb, where he's buried. So, very emotional. A lot happening. Honored that I would be able to get that script written by Mimi Wan. And just be able to be there and witness it. It's there are quite a few times I will tell you that I neglected to call cut on time because I was so wrapped up in what was happening.
Oh, wow.
And the actors are just so good.
So, you know, you talked about how seeing the palette of faces and people in each episode is so very important. And that made me think about wanting to play. We've got a clip here from Queen mm-hmm. Sugar because we've been hearing a lot of positive stuff about how it portrays black men as well. And in this clip, you're going to hear Ralph Angel, the character Ralph Angel, played by Kofi Siribo.
Siribo, yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Kofi.
No problem.
And he discovers a letter written by his deceased father and then draws a contrast with how black men are usually portrayed in Hollywood.
Mm. Pop's handwriting.
You, Ralph Angel, are more than you know. Whatever has happened, whatever you've done in the past, never forget that you are better than you think.
In the letter, I like that his father wrote to me, said, "You are so much better than you know." I don't see that being portrayed when it comes down to black men everywhere. That we're so much better than what we know. That we're so much stronger than what we know. That we're so much more beautiful than what we know.
And so that there is a cut both from the film and you hear actor Kofi Siribo. So, Domaine, tell me, was that meaningful for you that here also, not just in your episode, but the series overall, was this vehicle to really sort of kind of smash Hollywood conventions when it comes to portrayal of people of color in a multiplicity of ways.
Yeah, I will tell you, I will let you in on something that I had a revelation in the last few years. I had to write an essay for a script that I was submitting to a workshop, and asked why I wanted to create a television show. And it wasn't until I wrote this essay that I realized that when I was younger, one of my favorite TV shows was Mannix. And it was about like a private detective, you know, white guy with slick back hair. And he had a secretary named Peggy. And my first real job was a secretary. And it wasn't until then that I realized I would watch that show and I was like, yeah, I could do that. And so that's why it's important.
Right.
That's why it's important. And it took me that many decades to realize that's why I knew. I never questioned that I could be a secretary. I questioned I could take the typing test. I failed the first time and then I got in. But yeah. Yeah. And so you don't get to see that. And this is showing all the shades, all the colors, all the emotions. It's mm-hmm. really important.
So here's the thing I feel both hopeful and then maybe a little cynical about. And that is, on the one hand, you know, we have folks like Ava DuVernay and Queen Sugar and what she's trying to do in terms of giving more sort of running room for female directors, people of color, stories about people of color, which is great. And hopefully it's keeping you busy, like the opportunities are keeping you busy thereafter. But on the other hand, even though there's this like giant flowering of Hollywood through, you know, television and streaming and film and all that stuff, it still feels like there's a super long ways to go. And so, you know, we shouldn't be happy until folks like Ava DuVernay and these projects are the rule rather than the exception.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. There's definitely a long way to go, but I'm so excited that it's happening now when we get to see it, we get to witness it. And I think it's about being present and then about saying to yourself, like, well, what do I want to do? What do I want to make? Who do I want to work with?
Yeah.
And I think now is that opportunity.
So you just got a couple seconds left. You're gonna stay in Boston?
I'm gonna stay in Boston. I'll be in Boston. My family's here. Boston will always be my base.
Okay. Is it a good place to be a base for someone in the film industry?
Yeah. I think things are happening here. The film tax credit is still around, which is good. And I plan to direct a couple of series here. So that's my plan in the future.
Oh, okay.
That's my goal. Put it out there into
the
universe.
Now you're teasing us.
I'll come back and tell you about it.
Well, Domaine Davis is a Boston-based filmmaker. Her new episode in the series Queen Sugar will air in November on the OWN Network. The mid-season premiere of Queen Sugar airs tonight. Domaine Davis, what a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the work you do. I appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh. It's my privilege. Now, I'm hoping that along with listening to this show, you listen to Modern Love, the podcast as well. It's from us here at WBUR and the New York Times, and I am lucky enough to be your host on that terrific project, too. So for the rest of this week, we're going to be sharing excerpts from Modern Love, the podcast with you, and today, one that features Asha Bendeli's essay. Now, we can't control the curveballs that life throws at us, but we can control how we handle them. And Asha decided that she needed to face the biggest one of her life alone. Cynthia Adai Robinson, star of the USA series Shooter, reads Asha's essay, "I Need to Woman Up and Do This on My Own."
5 months after we were married, my husband, Rashid, and I had a honeymoon of sorts. A 44-hour jaunt in a trailer at the New York State prison where he lived. At 21, he had been convicted of a gang-related murder, which occurred 3 years before, and on this day, he was in the 13th year of a 20-year sentence. We had met 5 years earlier, when I was 23, a college student teaching poetry to prisoners. I believed then, as I do now, that poems can expand a soul. They had done so for me, and I was watching the same thing happen to prisoners, especially Rashid, already a man seeking transformation. Over the course of a year and many discussions about changing ourselves and our world, we fell in love. With Rashid, there was this breadth of dialogue I hadn't experienced before. Our conversations, unspeakably honest, were for me life-saving. When I met Rashid, a failed marriage already behind me, no college degree yet, no direction for my future, I saw my life as a series of mistakes. He set that lie aside, made me see myself through his eyes until I could love my reflection. When I could no longer stand not being able to touch this man who had so touched me, we married in the prison visiting room. 5 months later, we qualified for conjugal visits, and in a small two-bedroom trailer in a yard on the prison grounds, we made love again and again. But more, we had a period of semi-normalcy. We cooked, danced slow, watched television, showered together. For 5 years, this was our life. The life we chose. I didn't tell Rashid during this time that I would never have a baby with him while he was locked up. I knew many women with incarcerated husbands did so, and while I didn't judge them, it wasn't for me. I didn't want to be a single parent or bring a baby into a prison. But I didn't say this because, at the time, I didn't think I could get pregnant. I had been married before and never conceived. I made love to my husband and didn't worry. Three weeks later, I found out I was pregnant. I never considered keeping the baby. Even as I wept, listened to Rashid's pleading, I knew I wouldn't keep it. It wasn't just the prison or my unwillingness to be a single parent. It was also financial. Whatever income I generated as a freelance writer and poet covered the rent, lights, and food, but precious little else. What did I have to offer a child except instability? Against the love I felt for the baby who'd barely begun to take shape inside of me, I had an abortion in a Manhattan clinic that seemed less like a medical center than a factory. Despite the doctors, the nurses, all those women waiting just outside for their turn on the table, it was the most alone I've ever felt. Though having the abortion was the right thing to do, I carried guilt about it for years. Had I been married under normal circumstances, I surely would have had the baby. The weight of destroying something that was created from great love was nearly unbearable. There was no way I could ever do it again. A few years later, I was on a book tour, celebrating what I felt was the beginning of my career, when Rashid and I were issued a date for a trailer. I flew home, armed myself with birth control, and never thought once about the possibility of pregnancy. I was thinking about what was next for me on the literary horizon. We made love and talked about our dreams, and when my period was a couple of days overdue, it didn't occur to me that I might be pregnant. But after 6 or 7 days, reluctantly, I bought a test. The stick turned into dark pink double lines that could not be denied. When Rashid called, I told him directly, "We're having a baby." I never thought not to have this baby. She created herself in spite of spermicides. Her presence was predetermined, and I was 32. I might not have another chance to be the one thing I always wanted to be, a mother. Still, there were fears. I worried about finding a stable job and childcare. I was terrified of going through labor alone. But mostly, I worried whether I would be able to raise a black girl safely in a world that seems to expand in its ability to hate and destroy. Living in a culture where violence is extolled and blacks and women are often stand-ins for the bullseye, I worried about whether the life of my girl could be honored by anyone other than me. The rates of drug and alcohol abuse among young people, the violence that's glorified in pop culture, the girls who at 8 are having oral sex in school stairwells, and the groundswell of so-called good girls out on the stroll terrified me. Not because I judged any of these kids, but because I had been my own version of them. Against a Manhattan backdrop, my sister and I were given music, dance, horseback riding, swimming lessons, and art classes. I attended private schools, went to the ballet, saw Judith Jameson dance. But it was also a childhood punctured by violence. All the education and culture were no armor against the excesses and dangers of growing up in an urban environment too unwieldy to notice its children coming undone. I began high school at 12, graduated at 15, and while I could put on heels and stumble behind the older girls, I couldn't negotiate the social settings, bars and clubs, where I found myself. On more than one occasion, what began for me as a fun night on the town ended as a date rape. There was always racism. When my child reached an age when she would have to negotiate survival, would she know how to speak to me as I was unable to speak to my parents? Would I know how to listen? And I had both my parents. My daughter had only me, and she would have to spend the first years of her life passing through metal detectors. Those concerns, more than any others, kept me awake through the nights wondering, where could I go? Where could I raise my child safely? I wanted to run, live off the grid, have my child, tell no one, keep her forever in my womb. But I had to stay connected to Rashid, even as my trips to the prison became more hellish. The prison guards, normally disdainful of family members, became especially awful once I swelled with life. During one visit, I had to request toilet paper 4 times so that I could please, please go to the bathroom. The love between Rashid and I no longer disguised the blight, the stench, and a terrible question took form in my head. As a mother, would I be able to navigate the prisons and maintain my relationship with Rashid? But the rounder my tummy became, the more those fears either fell away or shrank to a manageable size. I gave myself over to reason, faith, Dr. Spock. I found work and childcare too. And I made it through labor, quite easily. My water broke a minute after midnight. And less than 11 hours later, my daughter Nisa was in my arms. 7 hours later, we were home and I was eating pizza. 15 days after that, I was placing Nisa's body in her father's arms for the first time. He cried at the sight of her. And I wept too, but from the frustration of not having a place where we could be at the most basic level of family. "You're such a good mother," my sister said once and then added, "How do you do it?" I heard this a lot during the first 2 years of Nisa's life, when I was writing a novel, working full-time, and meeting my deadlines. I told her not to believe the facade. It's impossibly hard to be a single mother. I hate having to be the sole emotional and financial provider for my child. The pressure's too great. If you slip, there's no one to catch you. But worse, there's no one to catch your baby. So somewhere among potty training, play dates, bylines, and balancing the household books, I lost pieces of myself I'm only now trying to reclaim. I started smoking again. I spent too many nights drinking wine and crying. There were times when pain threatened to define the whole of me. And no, I couldn't hold my marriage together. Caring for Rashid and Nisa at the same time was more than I could bear. The weekly treks through metal detectors, the parts of my spirit that always got snagged by the razor wire. I still take Nisa to see her father, but staying romantically entangled with Rashid when I most feel his absence was too painful. Every time I see her change, fall down, stand up again, I'm reminded that the only other person who loves her as I do isn't there to bear witness to her beauty. No one would ever lose an hour, as I still do, just watching her sleep. How could I live with that? "I can't play at house or marriage anymore," is what I finally said. "I love you, but I need to woman up and do this on my own." Still, in that breakup, I felt like I lost my husband, best friend, father, and brother all at once. And I didn't just lose him. I banished him. For that, I may never be able to forgive myself. But I had to choose my child. Again. Most mornings, I'm awakened by Nisa's messy kisses, her eyes ablaze with mischief and wonder. Nisa's query to me each sunrise is, "What's our big adventure today, Mommy?" I grin back at my beloved, my child, and my mind begins to work. But before I come up with a plan, this is what I think each time she asks. "Yes, beloved. Our big adventure indeed. Ours."
Cynthia Adai Robinson reading Asha Bandali's essay, "I Need to Woman Up and Do This on My Own." Now, we let the actors pick what essays they want to read for us, and Cynthia says that she became emotional the first time she read Asha's story.
I was actually raised in a single-parent household, a different set of circumstances, but I can very much relate to a situation that is not one that you saw for yourself, but kind of needing to pull it together for the sake of your child, for the sake of yourself. There's a real strength in that, and I am in awe of all mothers, but in particular of in awe of single mothers who have the most important job in the world, in my opinion.
Thanks again to Cynthia Adai Robinson for reading Asha's essay. You can see Cynthia in season 2 of Shooter. It's available on demand from USA Network. Now, don't forget, subscribe to the Modern Love Podcast, if you haven't already, wherever you get your podcasts, and put it right there next to the Radio Boston podcast. You can find more information about Modern Love at wbur.org/modernlove. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Sean Bowden and Brian Bouchard. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.